Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Okay, good evening, everyone. Okay, today we will be taking for a study Sutta number 50 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called Mara Tajaniya Sutta, which Venerable Nyanamoli had rendered the rebuke to Mara. I warned you last time, those who are here, that this is a somewhat strange sutta, but we take a look at it anyway and see. It's strange, but also quite interesting. But we see what kind of message or information we can extract from it. Okay, the main figure in this sutta is not the Buddha, but it's the Venerable Mahamoggallana. For those of you who don't know about the Buddha's disciples, Venerable Mahamoggallana was one of the two chief disciples of the Buddha. The two chief disciples were Venerable Sariputta and Venerable Mahamoggallana. And these two disciples had different specializations, you might say. Venerable Sariputta's specialization was wisdom. He was the one who is described as a monk of sharp wisdom, quick wisdom, wide wisdom, vast wisdom, penetrative wisdom, and so on. And the Venerable Sariputta would often take themes from the Buddha's teachings and then elaborate upon them, analyze them, dissect them, expound them in detail. And so for this reason, we have in the collected discourses, Buddhist discourses, we have many suttas, important suttas, spoken by Venerable Sariputta. For example, in the middle-length discourses, we have the Sutta number 9, the Discourse on Right View, Sutta number 28, the Greater Discourse on the Elephant's Footprint, Sutta number 141, the Analysis of the Four Noble Truths, and others. Mahamoggallana was the disciple whose specialization was what we call iddhi. Iddhi means psychic. Well, sometimes it's translated as psychic powers or spiritual powers. And we often find in the suttas, we've come across this time and again, a stock passage describing the iddhis or psychic powers. Some of them include having one body, one becomes many, one appears in many places at the same time. Then being in many places, one comes back to one's one body. One can pass through thick obstructions like walls, ramparts, mountains, blocks of wood or stone without obstruction. One can walk across water without sinking. One could sink into the earth and rise out. without any impediment. One can fly through the sky like a bird. And one could even touch the sun and moon, so it said. And so the Venerable Mahamoggallana was the disciple who had mastered to the utmost extent all of these iddhis, or supernormal powers. When this sutta begins, Venerable Mahamoggallana is, apparently he's living alone, and he's walking up and down in the open. This was a kind of meditation, doing a kind of walking meditation. Or perhaps he's just walking up and down for exercise. Okay, now at that time, according to the sutta, Mara went into the Venerable Mahamoggallana's belly and entered his bowels. Okay, now Mara is, in early Buddhism, he is described as the evil one. He's the Buddhist counterpart of Satan. Is it pronounced Satan or Satan? Satan, the devil. Except that there's an important difference between Mara and the devil and Christianity, and that is that Mara has no particular intention of pulling people down to hell. His task is to prevent people from gaining liberation. And so he's quite happy if people are content, enjoying themselves, if they go to a rebirth in the heavenly world and enjoy themselves in heaven. In all such cases, Mara feels that his purpose is fulfilled. His aim is simply to obstruct anyone who seeks to gain liberation from the round of birth and death. It's sometimes thought that in the early Buddhist discourses, Mara is just a symbol for the defilements of the mind, especially sensual lust. And it seems in some passages, Mara is closely connected with sensual lust. We see one of the ways in which he operates is to provoke sensual desire in those who seek to live a life of renunciation. And by arousing sensual desire in them, then Mara gets what is called otara in Pali, which means he gets a grip on them. He gets a foothold in them. And by getting a grip on them, he's able to prevent them from escaping into the realm of Nibbana, the realm of ultimate liberation. Okay, even though Mara is closely connected with the defilements and with sensuality, if we look at the discourses and try to take the viewpoint of the Nikayas themselves, Mara is not merely a symbol for sensuality or defilements, but he's regarded as an actual living being, a living being whose function is to tempt people and keep them in bondage. Where does Mara dwell? In what realm? He comes into the human realm and he interacts with human beings. But the suttas themselves don't, at least to my knowledge, they don't provide any information about Mara's home dwelling place. According to the commentaries, commentaries written in Pali, maybe early centuries of the Common Era, according to the commentaries, Mara's dwelling place, his home dwelling place, is in the heavenly realm. It said that Mara occupies, if you remember that the sensual heavenly realms are divided into six levels, the six heavens of the sense sphere. The highest heaven in the sense sphere is called, what is it called? Paranimitta Vasavati heaven, which means the heaven of those who exercise control over the creations of others. And the commentaries say that Mara occupies one part of this heavenly realm, like a rebel prince, a prince who rebels against his father, the king, and so the rebel prince can't dwell in the central region of the country, but the rebel prince gets chased away and dwells in the borderlands, trying to launch attacks against his father, the king, in order to usurp the throne. And so it said that Mara dwells in a remote corner of this heavenly realm. But it doesn't say that he launches attacks against the other deities in that realm, but rather from that borderland of the heavenly realm, he comes down into the human realm and launches attacks against human beings. Okay, so in this case, the text says, whether to take this literally or symbolically, I don't know, but Mara comes into Mahamoggallana's belly and then enters his bowels. And now at this time, Moggallana is an arahant, which means that he's liberated in mind from all of the defilements. So Mara, from the standpoint of the text itself, can't be just a symbol for sensuality, because Moggallana has completely eliminated sensual craving. He's eliminated all the defilements. So from the point of view of the text, we can't regard Mara merely as a symbol for sensuality. If he were a symbol, then he wouldn't be able to attack Mahamoggallana. So when Mara enters Moggallana's belly, enters his bowels, then Moggallana suddenly feels some difference in his body. Maybe there's a feeling like he's he has a case of constipation. Or a case of indigestion or constipation. So he reflects to himself, why is my belly so heavy? It seems that he's eaten a meal of beans and hasn't been able to digest them. Okay, so then he leaves his walkway and goes back into his dwelling, sits down, and then he examines himself, probably using his divine eye, not just thinking what's happened to me, but he uses his divine eye to see into his body. And when he looks into his body, then he sees Mara dwelling in his bowels. Okay, so when he sees this, then he scolds Mara and says, get out, evil one, get out, evil one. Don't harass the Tathagata, that is the Buddha. Don't harass a disciple, an enlightened disciple of the Tathagata, or this will lead to your harm and suffering for a long time. Okay, when Moggallana says this, then Mara is still hesitant to leave, and he thinks to himself, this ascetic, this recluse, does not know me, does not see me when he says that. He's just, in other words, he's just guessing. Even his teacher, that is the Buddha, would not know me so quickly. So how can this disciple, this mere disciple, know me? Then Moggallana, through his psychic power, is able to read Mara's thought. And then he tells Mara, don't think that I do not see you, that I do not know that you're there. Okay, when Moggallana says this, then Mara thinks, indeed, he knew me, he saw me when he said that. And so then Mara comes out from Moggallana's mouth, and then he stands against the door. Probably he's tried to make himself invisible, because Moggallana sees him standing there and says, I see you there. Also, Mara, do not think I do not see you. I see you standing against the door bar. Okay, so this is the setting, you could say the setting for the discourse. And now we enter into the main part of the discourse itself. At this point, we're in paragraph 8, Moggallana says, one time in the past, evil one, I was a Mara named Dusi. Dusi means something like defiled, or perhaps defiler, one who defiles, one who corrupts others. And I had a sister named Kali. This is interesting because Kali became an important goddess in popular Hinduism. Even today, she is a major goddess in Hinduism, the goddess of destruction, of darkness and destruction. Okay, and now Moggallana continues, I had a sister named Kali. You were her son, so you were my nephew. Now, this might seem to be a bit confusing, so we have to explain a little bit about the background. Now, we speak about Mara as being the tempter in Buddhism, the one who tries to corrupt, tempt, and mislead others. But according to Buddhism, this figure Mara is not a permanent position, or let's say, it's not one individual, one living being who remains permanently in that position, but rather in the Buddhist cosmology, Mara is something like a position, a formal position, and different living beings at different times occupy that position. It's somewhat like, could be the King of England, the King or Queen of England. Well, it gets a little complicated because we have kings and queens of England. Okay, let us say a little bit, I don't want to seem to be attacking Obama here. He has enough problems from the GOP. But a little bit like the position of President of the United States. Maybe if Bush was still president, it would be more fitting. Okay, we have a position of President of the United States elected every 4 years. And so we speak about the president. The president did this. The president went to Europe. The president proposed this. But it's not the case that there's one individual who permanently occupies the position of president. But every 4 years, or it could be every 8 years, there's a change of presidents. And so though we go on speaking about the president, it's a different human being who occupies the position of president. So similarly, in the Buddhist cosmology, Mara is a position. I guess it comes with an office, special residential facility. One gets a staff of assistants, clerks, secretaries, chief of staff. Maybe he has a cabinet as well, I don't know. But you only occupy that position maybe longer than 4 or 8 years, maybe a whole kalpa or aeon. But when the time comes to an end, then your position comes to an end, one passes away from that realm, and then some other living being will take rebirth in the position of Mara. So at this time, at the time that Moggallana is now speaking about, he himself, who is now second chief disciple of the Buddha, a fully enlightened, liberated arahant, he himself had the position of Mara. And he even had a proper name, which is Dusi. Again, it means the corrupter, the defiler. And this gets a little strange, but he has a sister. And the sister has a son in this realm. Do people get married and have sexual relations and beget children in that way? I don't know. But anyway, there are brothers and sisters, families. Maybe we have to look after our families, make sure they have secure standard of living. Okay, and the sister had a son, and the person who was the son at that time was now Mara, the one who occupies the position of Mara. So at this time, the present Mara was a kind of little demon who worked his way up in the hierarchy till at present he occupies the position of Chief Mara. But at that time, the one who was occupying the position of Chief Mara is the person who is now Mahamoggallana. At this time, there was another Buddha in the world. This is long before the time of Gautama or Shakyamuni Buddha. At that time, the Buddha who was teaching in the world was named Kakusanda. I think this must be a long, long time ago. There were actually several Buddhas between Kakusanda and Gautama Buddha. So Kakusanda had a pair of chief disciples. Every Buddha has a pair of chief disciples. And the chief disciples of this Buddha were named Vidura and Sanjiva. Vidura and Sanjiva, these names are nice Pali and also Sanskrit names. So apparently during the time of that Buddha, they were also using Pali, Sanskrit, or some other Indian-type language related to Pali and Sanskrit. Okay, now the text is going to explain why these chief disciples had these names. The word Vidura means without an equal, unequaled. And so the text says, there was none equal to the venerable Vidura in teaching the Dhamma. Okay, I understand the explanation. Okay, it says, Nasu da kochi ayasmata vidurena sama samo hoti yadidang tamadesanaya. Yeah, so it's sort of, the text is making a word play on the name Vidura. So Vidura means without a counterpart, without an equal, and the text uses a different word to indicate that there was no one equal to him. So this is why this monk was called Vidura. Apparently the name was given to him at a later time. It was not his proper name. Okay, the more interesting case is why the other monk was called Sanjiva. The word Sanjiva can have the meaning of one who is living, one who is alive, one who is still alive. Okay, now this monk named Vidura, Sanjiva, went Oh, I see the sense now. Okay. Okay, the sense is that the Venerable Sanjiva was able to enter without difficulty the cessation of perception and feeling. It's not the case only that on one occasion he went to the forest or the root of a tree and entered it, but as a general ability, he was able on any occasion he wanted to enter this special meditative attainment called the cessation of perception and feeling. A few sessions ago, I explained that meditative attainment. This is a meditative state which one enters after passing. First, one has to pass through the four jhanas. Then one passes through the four arupas, the four formless meditative attainments. Then after one passes through the four formless meditative attainments, then one enters into this state called the cessation of perception and feeling, in which all perception, all feeling are temporarily cut off. So it's a state which is quite inconceivable to us. We have trouble just keeping our mind on a simple meditation object, but this is a meditative state where it's possible to reduce, first one reduces, slows down the processes of perception and feeling, makes them extremely refined, refines them to the ultimate degree, and then through a determination, an act of will, one brings them to a complete stop. So there's no perception, no feeling. Okay, now on one occasion, this monk named Sanjiva was sitting at the root of a tree and he entered the cessation of perception and feeling. And now at that time, some cowherds, shepherds, farmers, travelers were working or passing by, and they saw the monk Sanjiva sitting with his body erect, having entered the cessation of perception and feeling. And he was absolutely motionless. They must have gone up to him, put their hands up against his nostrils, no feeling of any breath. Perhaps the pulse stops also, so they took his pulse, no pulse. And then they concluded that this monk has died even while sitting. And so then they thought, we can't just leave him sitting here, we have to cremate him. And so then they piled up grass, wood, twigs, cow dung, and so on. And then they set it alight and they thought they were cremating his body, and as the flames engulfed the body, then they walked away. Now, there's a special ability that accrues to one who enters the perception of who enters the cessation of perception and feeling, that is that his body cannot be burnt by fire, cannot be harmed or injured in any way. How this occurs, it's beyond our conception, but this meditative attainment somehow encompasses the body, envelops the body with a protective force so that it cannot be harmed in any way. It's like an invisible shield that protects the body. And so even though the flames were rising up and engulfing the body of this monk Sanjiva, his body was completely unharmed. But because he had no perception, no feeling, he was unaware of the fire around him. Okay, then the day comes to an end. the night comes to an end, and then the Venerable Sanjiva emerges from that attainment. He comes out from this deep meditative state. It's morning now, and he wants to go on alms round. So he must have seen the ashes all around him. Maybe he was perplexed. Suddenly, why are these ashes all around? When I sat down here to meditate, it was a nice green lawn under a tree, and now suddenly it's just a mass of ashes around him. But he takes his robes, dusts them, shakes them, cleans off the ashes, then he straightens out his robes, takes his alms bowl, and then goes into the village on alms round. And this village is the place where these cowherds, shepherds, farmers are living. And so then they see this monk Sanjiva, and they're astounded. How is this possible? Yesterday he was dead. We cremated him while he was sitting. And now he's come back to life. Yeah, the expression they use, he is Pati Sanjivito. Pati means again or back, and Sanjivito means living, alive. So he's again alive, Pati Sanjivito. So in this way, according to the sutta, this monk got the name, or probably it's a nickname, a sobriquet, Sanjiva. Okay, now we come to the important part of the discourse. In paragraph 12, now the Mara Dusi, who is Moggallana in a previous life, considers or reflects, there are these virtuous monks of good character, but I do not know their coming or their going. That is, Mara tries to keep track of everybody, to know what's going on in their minds. He has the ability to read their thoughts, to see into the deep layers of their minds. And then he uses this knowledge in order to trap people, to tempt them, corrupt them, trap them, and then pull them away from the path of virtue, the way to liberation, and keep them within his grasp. Okay, and so Mara doesn't know the coming and going of these monks. This doesn't mean that he doesn't know where they're going or where they're coming from, but rather he's, because of their purity of virtue, He's not able to get a grip on their minds. In other words, because of their virtue, they provide, they set out a protective shield which prevents Mara from getting a grip on them. So Mara wants to find some way to corrupt them, to cause them to fall from their state of virtue and meditative development, and then he'll be able to get a grip on their minds. And so now he devises a plan. He thinks to himself, let me take possession of the Brahmin householders. And this is his plan. He's going to get possession of the householders, the Brahmin householders, and make them abuse, revile, scold, and harass these monks. And then, when they're abused and reviled, he's hoping that some change will take place in their mind. That is, when they're abused and reviled, they might become angry against the people who abuse and revile them. And if they become angry, then Mara is able to get a grip on their mind because of their anger. Or they might become upset, feeling miserable. If they become upset, Mara gets a grip on them. What else could happen if they're abused and reviled? Angry, upset, what else? What other reaction? Negative reaction. What?
Violence.
Even they might even become violent. But probably not physically, but just if they're abused and reviled, then what might they do?
Hatred? Well, hatred
is, well, it's similar to getting angry. But if one is abused and reviled, what could one do? Exactly. One will retaliate. And so one can, if the Brahmin householders abuse them, then they will abuse the Brahmin householders and shout back abusive words in return. Okay, so then, according to the text, Mara takes possession of the Brahmin householders and he makes them abuse, revile, scold, and harass the monks. And this is these are the words they uttered, the Brahmin householders. They say to the monks, these bald-pated recluses, these swarthy, actually they're dark, menial offspring of the kinsmen's feet. In the text, this is a stock way in which Brahmins abuse sometimes the Buddha, sometimes Buddhist monks, because there was a kind of antagonism between the Brahmins and the other group of religious figures on the Indian scene, the samanas or ascetics. Yeah, the Brahmins didn't like the ascetics because the ascetics did not accept the authority of the Vedas. They generally disapproved of practices like sacrifice. this maintaining the sacrificial fire. The Brahmins married and begot children, whereas the Samanas lived lives of celibacy. And so the Brahmins were resentful towards the Samanas, the ascetics, and they would sometimes scold them and harass them and revile them using words like this. And then they, according to this text, they ridicule these monks for sitting in meditation. They say that you sit there with your shoulders drooping, your heads down, your body all limp, and the sutta uses a number of words, which is just approximately translated here. You meditate, pre-meditate, out-meditate, mis-meditate. There's no real special meaning in the different words. It's just a way of inflicting ridicule upon these monks. Okay, then the Brahmins use a number of similes, again, to ridicule them. Okay, now the text tells us at the end of this passage, and this strikes me as a bit strange, that on that occasion, most of those human beings, the ones who scolded the monks, when they died, reappeared or were reborn after death in the lower world, even in hell. It seems to me that this is unfair. Because it's Mara that takes possession of these householders, and Mara is sort of motivating them to abuse the virtuous monks. But the commentary tries to get around this, so to justify it, by saying that Mara did not actually take full possession of those Brahmin householders. But what Mara did was to display to those householders display those monks engaged in unsuitable actions. So what Mara did was to display to the monks, Mara would display, sort of create a magical picture using his own psychic powers. He would create a magical picture of those monks fishing at a lake using fishing nets. He would create magical picture of the monks trapping birds in the forest or hunting for animals in the forest, or pictures of the monks engaged in sexual relations with women. When in front of the householders, when the householders would be going away, say, along a field, Mara would display pictures, sort of magically created pictures of the monks engaged in these bad actions. And so the householders would then perceive the monks acting in this way, and they would go back and they would complain to the other people and spread bad reports about the monks and speak badly about the monks. And in this way, they created unwholesome karma, which led to that bad rebirth. Even in this case, I have to say, maybe speaking from my modernist perspective, that it wouldn't be fair if Mara is creating these pictures of the monks violating their precepts. Then it would be quite natural for the householders to complain. And so why should the householders then get a bad rebirth because of that? Anyway, this is what the text says. Okay, but now the Buddha of that period, Kakusanda, gives some advice to the monks some advice which is designed to instruct them how to respond or how to develop their minds so that they will not be negatively affected by the abuse that Mara is inflicting upon them. Okay, first, the Buddha tells the monks that it's Mara who's taken possession of the householders and is motivating them to abuse and revile you. So now the Buddha continues, come, O monks, abide pervading one quarter with a mind of loving kindness, likewise the second quarter, third quarter, fourth quarter, dwell pervading this whole world with a mind of boundless loving kindness. Again, abide pervading the whole world with a mind of compassion, with a mind of mudita, altruistic joy, with a mind of equanimity. Okay, and so the monks accept this advice from the Buddha, and then they go into the forest and they dwell with the mind of loving kindness, compassion, altruistic joy, and equanimity. So in other words, they develop the four Brahma-viharas. So because they've developed the mind of boundless loving kindness and compassion, if the Brahmin householders scold them and abuse them, then the monks just radiate loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity towards these householders. And when they do this, then the householders are not able to continue abusing and reviling them, because the power of this loving kindness is, or we could say the emanation of this loving kindness, the vibrations of the loving kindness are so powerful and wonderful that when the householders get suffused with those rays, then they start feeling love and devotion and respect towards the monks. Okay, so now Mara has been foiled using this tactic to get possession of the monks. So now he's going to try to use another tactic. This will be the opposite approach. So now Mara tells himself, I'm in paragraph 16, okay, though I do as I am doing, still I do not know the coming or the going of these virtuous monks of good character. In other words, I'm still not able to get a grip on them. Let me now take possession of the Brahmin householders, motivating them in this way. We will honor, respect, revere, and venerate the virtuous monks of good character. And then perhaps when they're honored, respected, and venerated, and so on, then some change will come about in their mind, whereby Mara will get an opportunity, get a grip on them. Okay, now what will happen if Mara respects, honors, reveres the monks, and they're not properly developing their minds? What happens then?
We get egotistical and self-centered.
Yeah, they become proud. They think that they're somebody special. Then they become maybe full of kind of self-love, self-cherishing. And then Mara will know, ah, that's my opportunity. There's my opening. And then Mara moves in and gets a grip on them. Okay, this is actually depicting a scene which, I mean, I, living as a monk, I've witnessed this happen many times, that sometimes, okay, when living in Sri Lanka, there'll be a monk who has a special skill as a preacher, and he might begin as quite a humble, simple, unassuming monk. He starts giving lectures and discourses. Then, because he has this intrinsic skill, then people are very impressed by his discourses. They tell other people, you have to come, listen to so-and-so when he's preaching. Then, before long, hundreds and hundreds of people are coming to listen to his lectures. Then after his lectures, they form a society to support the monk. Then they ask him, Venerable, what can we do for you? I want to have a monastery of my own. I don't want to go on living in this monastery with the other monks. They build him his own monastery. Sometimes it will be, he will give them instructions. You know the palace that so-and-so, the ancient kings used to live in. I want to have a monastery modeled on that ancient palace. So they'll build a big, luxurious monastery for him. Then they will be bringing him all sorts of requisites. Venerable, do you need a radio? Radio would be good. Can we offer you television? Okay, why not? We have to get informed what's going on in the modern world. Television. They bring luxurious food. Every day he gets maybe 20 or 30 dishes. Okay, so in this way, then they praise him. Word comes out to the ministers. The ministers of state come to visit him. This would be like the cabinet members in the U.S. They come to visit him and pay respects to him. Then the prime minister comes to see him. President comes to see him. And then he becomes very proud. And when he meets with other monks, he doesn't want to associate with other monks. And he thinks, I'm somebody special. Okay, so in this way, the mind opens up to conceit, self-love, praise of oneself, disparagement of others, and attachment to worldly benefits. Okay, so now Mara takes possession of the monks, of the Brahmin householders, and they come to the monks, they pay respects to them, venerate them, make offerings to them. And the text tells us, again, this is unfair in my opinion, on that occasion, most of those human beings, when they died, after their death, they were reborn in the heavenly realm. Why should they be reborn in the heavenly realm if Mara is motivating them to do this? Okay, so any case, now the Buddha gives some advice to the monks so that they could protect themselves from this tactic of Mara. The Buddha first warns them that Mara has taken possession of these householders, and now you should dwell practicing these meditations, practicing contemplation of the foulness of the body, meditating that this body is just a combination of various organs, tissues, fluids, nothing beautiful or attractive in this body, perceiving the repulsiveness and nutriment, even though you get all of these delicious foods that they offer you, just see it as substances that you eat to maintain this body, perceiving disenchantment with all the world, think about all of the miseries and sufferings in worldly existence, contemplate impermanence in all conditioned things. Okay, and so then these monks, whenever they had opportunity to meditate, they would meditate as they were instructed by the Buddha. And by meditating in this way, Mara was unable to get a grip on those monks because they were no longer attracted to receiving honors, venerations, and worldly offerings. So now Mara is feeling really angry and frustrated. So on one occasion, he takes possession of a certain boy, and he picks up a stone. This is one day when the Buddha is walking to the village on alms round with the Venerable Vidura as his attendant monk. So Mara takes possession of a boy. The boy picks up a stone and throws it, not at the Buddha, but he throws it at the disciple, Vidura, and hits him on the head and cuts the head so that blood is flowing. Now, this is an extremely dangerous karmic action. If Mara were to throw that stone and hit the Buddha and cut his head so that the blood is flowing, then it becomes one of the five, what's called the five anantariyas, one of the five karmas with immediate effect that will lead to a rebirth in hell. But throwing the stone and cutting the disciple's head is also a very heavy karma. In this case, it will also lead to a rebirth in hell. So when this happens, then the Buddha turns around. It's said that he turns around and looks at him with the elephant look. What does this mean? It doesn't mean that the Buddha turns into an elephant, but it's said that when an elephant wants to turn around to look at something, he doesn't just turn his head this way, but the elephant, to look behind him, turns his whole body. And in the same way, when the Buddha wants to see something going on to his side or behind him, he doesn't turn his head. No, he doesn't just turn his head to the side or turn the head all around, but he turns the whole body around. This is a kind of indicates the self-possession and the bodily dignity of the Buddha. To turn around, he'll turn the whole body. So in this case, he turns around and he looks at Mara and says, this Mara Dusi, literally, he doesn't know the proper measure. Here it's translated a little freely, he knows no bounds. And when the Buddha looks at him and says that, then immediately Mara Dusi passes away and takes rebirth in hell. It's not the case that the Buddha has willed him to take rebirth in hell, because the Buddha has compassion for everybody. But because of that very heavy, very severe, very serious, unwholesome karma of angrily throwing a stone at the Buddha's disciple and wounding him, that karma caused the rebirth in hell. Okay, and this hell has several names. It's called the hell of the six bases for contact, the hell of the impalement with stakes, and the hell to be felt for oneself. Okay, then, when this happens, then the wardens of hell come up. They come up to me. In this case, this is Moggallana speaking, when he was the Mara named Dusi, and they say, good sir, when one stake meets another stake in your heart, then you will know I have been roasting in hell for 1,000 years. And then Mara spent many a century, many a millennium, roasting in that great hell. And then after 10 millennia passed, he roasted in the auxiliary of that great hell, experiencing extremely painful feeling. And at that time, it said, his body had the form of a human being, but his head had the form of a fish's head. Maybe if you've seen some of the paintings of the early Renaissance, I think he's early Renaissance, Hieronymus Bosch. He draws these strange paintings of combining parts of different animals with human beings. So this seems reminiscent of a painting by Bosch. Okay, maybe at this point I will stop here and ask whether there's any questions. But maybe just instead of... Okay, first I'll ask whether there's any questions. Maybe I'll ask a question. This is a question that comes in my mind. What are we to make of a sutta like this? Do we take it literally? Figuratively? It seems that there had to be some point in the sutta being preserved in the canon. Is there a particular point? What purpose could it be serving? Any ideas? George?
Well, I think the meditations that the Buddha advises the disciples to use are good advice.
Yeah. And it seems to me, even though the story is placed at some point in the far distant past, during the reign of another Buddha, but it's actually depicting scenes that would have been everyday experiences in the lives of the monks. On the one hand, there would be those who, I've encountered this to some extent myself when I was living in Sri Lanka. When I was in India as a monk, believe it or not, this was in the mid-1970s, people would sometimes shout out, "Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna," if I would go walking down a street. Since in India, they don't even see Buddhist monks. And so they think when we're wearing this color robe that we are followers of the Krishna consciousness movement. And years ago in the U.S., it doesn't happen anymore. But sometimes when I was living in Sri Lanka, I would come to visit my parents. And it's not people usually not people on the streets, but people driving by in cars. If I'm walking down a busy avenue with cars going by, a boulevard, Nassau Boulevard near my father's house. As the car goes whizzing by, a voice would shout out, "Why don't you put on a decent pair of clothes? Hey, get real." Even one time, this was when I was living in the Washington Buddhist Vihara, 1980-81. "Hey, go back." This was the time of the Iran hostage crisis. "Hey, go back to Iran." Another time, this is again near my father's house, West Hempstead, walking down some street. Then I hear a voice calling out from the other side of the street, "Is that a guy? Is that a guy or a dame?" No response from me. So again, the voice is shouting out louder, "Is that a guy or a dame?" But I found that the way to overcome that is not to look up. If you look up at them, it means they win. If one just keeps the attention focused inwardly and doesn't pay attention, they lose because they feel foolish themselves for shouting out, or other people look at them and think, "Why are you shouting out like that?" Okay, so sometimes one gets abuse like that. And sometimes, again, this is especially living as a monk in Sri Lanka, people sometimes think that you are, maybe because I could give good talks, and maybe translate suttas so people think, ah, he's a holy monk, let us go make offerings to him. And even though I have my mind might be all distracted, uncontrolled, but people pay respect, veneration, and this could become an opportunity for conceit and delusion to arise, self-love and delusion. And so these two types of, call these two type meditative strategies, when subject to abuse, to scolding, practice the Brahma-viharas. One has to practice them beforehand so that one has a kind of what you might call the power of loving-kindness and the power of compassion. So then when you're actually in the situation of abuse, attack, being reviled, one could respond by generating that loving-kindness in the mind, generating compassion, or just responding with equanimity, not being moved by the attacks and by the abuse. Then on the occasion, if people are treating you with special kindness, providing special favors to you, respecting and venerating you, then don't be sucked in and trapped by this. Don't be seduced by this, but instead use these meditations that lead to disenchantment to keep the thought, the idea, the goal of liberation in mind.
Bhante, are there any suttas where the Buddha himself speaks of his knowledge of past lives? That's another thing that I found on this one strange, because I hadn't read it before, because Mahamoggallana clearly speaks about a past life as a Mara. And I didn't recall having heard any or read any where the Buddha himself speaks about his past life.
Yeah, there are a few in the, let's see, in the Majjhima Nikaya. Let me tell you which ones they are.
Okay.
Or at least give you some examples of such suttas. One is called the Gatikara Sutta. Is the Buddha speaking about his own past life there? Actually, no. But he's speaking about the past life of a person who became a very devoted lay follower of his. No, not his own personal lay follower. He's speaking about a past life of, well, of a devoted lay follower under an earlier Buddha. He doesn't identify with them. He doesn't identify them as persons in the present. But Sutta number 83, the Maggadeva Sutta, here the Buddha speaks about how in an earlier life he had, where he speaks about a king who had developed the four Brahma-viharas and had taken rebirth in the heavenly realms. And then the Buddha at the end of the sutta says, at that time, I was the king Maggadeva. Then there's a sutta in Digha Nikaya. This is sutta number 17. It's the Sudassana Sutta, when the Buddha speaks about how he was a king in a past life. He was the king named Sudassana. I don't see other such suttas off the bat in the Majjhima Nikaya. But there are a few other suttas here and there where the Buddha speaks about an earlier life of his.
Perhaps if I research it, I'll
Well, it's a little difficult to research. I'll try to gather some more information about it. Okay, now I remember another one. It comes in Anguttara Nikaya. I think this is the, let me see the name of it. My memory is not as good as it used to be. Velama Sutta, Velama Sutta. V-E-L-A-M-A. In that sutta, the Buddha says that he, in that earlier life, he was a layman and he had made extensive offerings to the Buddha, the Buddha at that time, the Sangha. And through that, he had gotten abundant merit. Then he became a teacher. I'd have to refresh the sutta in my mind. I'd have to look it up again to refresh my memory. But I'm sure that that sutta, the Buddha refers to himself as living in a past life. I think it's in the sevens or the eights of the Anguttara Nikaya. I'll try to find exactly where it is for you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Or any ideas about the purpose this sutta could have served? Okay, George?
Well, I was curious about, there was the one incident where I think a bad person in Buddha's life, Kentama, his nephew or cousin?
David Dutta?
Yes. Pushed a stone?
Or exactly, yeah.
And it cut the
Buddha. Exactly, yeah.
Was he thrown into hell?
Yeah, by throwing the stone, this is the Buddha's envious cousin, Devadatta. He hurled, his intention was to kill the Buddha. And so when the Buddha was living on Mount Vulture's peak, the Buddha was, I think, walking back and forth on a pathway of that mountain. And Devadatta was on a high point on another hill. And then he pushed a boulder with the idea that the boulder would go rolling down and would hit the Buddha and kill him. But the boulder, as it was rolling down, hit another stone and was deflected, but a splint broke off from the rolling boulder, and the splint flew and hit the Buddha in the leg and cut his leg so that blood was flowing. And now it's said that it's impossible to kill a Buddha because a Buddha has a natural lifespan, and through his karmic merit, he will live the full lifespan. But it's possible to wound a Buddha, and if one does so with a mind of hatred, then that creates one of these anantariya karmas, these karmas with immediate results. And so Devadatta committed that karma. And as a result, well, he committed a number of other bad actions. He tried to create a schism in the Sangha. He actually pulled away a large group of monks from the Buddha who came to follow him, thinking that he was an enlightened one. Maybe Devadatta, he must have been given very eloquent lectures, so he was able to attract these 500, it said 500 monks, but 500 is just a kind of metaphor for a large number. So they became followers of Devadatta, and that creates a schism in the Sangha. And then Sariputta and Moggallana went to visit Devadatta, And when Sariputta Moggallana were coming on the scene, Devadatta thought, ah, the Buddha's chief disciples are coming to see me. They have probably become disillusioned with the Buddha, and now they recognize my merits and virtues, and so they're going to become my disciples. And so while Devadatta was giving his lecture, Moggallana, Sariputta came, just sat down there quietly. But then when Devadatta finished his lecture and went off to go to sleep, then Sariputta Moggallana explained to these monks the faults in Devadatta's teaching and brought them back to the Buddha. Then Devadatta, feeling abandoned, became very morose and realized he felt a lot of compunction for his bad deeds and decided that he wanted to go back and to apologize to the Buddha. And so he started to go to the place where the Buddha was dwelling, but his karma was such that he didn't have the opportunity to apologize. While he was walking along that way, he expired, he passed away, and then he was reborn in hell. But it's said in the commentaries that while Moggallana was on his way back to apologize to the Buddha, when he felt himself starting to die, then he realized he'll never see the Buddha again. So then he recited, I take refuge in the Buddha. The Buddha is my only refuge. I pledge never to offend a Buddha again. And then the Buddha predicted that even though Devadatta has been reborn in hell, but at some future time, he'll come back to the human realm, achieve enlightenment and gain liberation. So everything has a happy ending in Buddhism. Yeah, maybe this is another message in the sutta that we have here in this sutta number 50, that we have this person, this figure, Mara Dusimara, who was the epitome of evil. But now look at him under the time of Gautama Buddha. He becomes the Buddha's chief disciple. And so this maybe is kind of message of encouragement. No matter how dark one's deeds might be, one always has a chance to reform, to transform oneself. And then by practicing properly, one could purify oneself and gain liberation. So one never has to feel completely despondent, that one is always bound down by one's evil deeds. Anything else? Okay, then we'll end now. There are some verses. I didn't go into the verses, but maybe you just read the verses on your own, and there are some notes that explain them. The verses actually just refer to, it's Moggallana speaking. What happens at the very end, I should just mention this. In the verses, Moggallana is speaking to the present Mara, because we have to remember, going back to the beginning, that Mara was trying to harass him and create trouble for him by entering into his belly and going into his bowels and upsetting his his body. And so now in the verses, Moggallana is giving a message to Mara, don't mess around with the disciple of the Buddha. Because if you do, you're going to be in trouble. And then Moggallana refers to some of his own, some events that took place in the past that attest to the, call the strength or the power of his psychic powers, to the we call this maybe the majesty of his psychic powers. And he refers to various incidents that take place in other suttas. Okay, next time, we'll have a class next Tuesday. What I will do is take sutta number 55. I just thought of another message from this Rebuke to Mara Sutta. If you get an upset stomach or constipation and you take medicines and none of them work, maybe you have to recite some blessing sutta to try to get Mara out from your body. Okay, next time I will take the Jivaka Sutta, which we can go through pretty quickly. It's not complicated sutta. And this sutta deals with the sometimes heated question of vegetarianism. Does Buddhism require one to become a vegetarian? And that sutta we could go through probably in 15 minutes. Then I will go into the Upali Sutta, which deals with some aspect of the debates taking place between the Buddhists and the Jains. So historically, it's an interesting sutta. Okay, so let us close for the evening by sharing the merits. We can share the merits with all the devas, the nagas, the buddhas, the fierce spirits, and even we could share the merits with any maras around.
Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavata ca amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe sata anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.